believe that central banks, politicians, with wild activist policies as we see today, are leading us into the jaws of another financial crisis.
They've tried to solve a debt crisis by printing trillions of dollars of more debt, but eventually you got to pay the money back.
Don't these guys see that adding more debt to a crisis that was caused by debt is sending us into another crisis at some point?
Well, I think the risk of a crisis being much worse are very high because, again, because of all the debt, because of the geopolitical stability, you know, global growth is terrible, global trade is down at recession or even 2008 levels. It's a very serious situation.
It raises a question as to why central banks are pursuing crisis-era policies like we see today, long after the crisis has passed.
The problem is nobody wants to connect the dots or just there's not the political will to force changes. Well, the global economy has a 100-pound pack on its back. It's called $200 trillion in debt and then this massive regulatory infrastructure. So how can the world possibly grow? It can't.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's special edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, we are during our summer recess period, so we're not going with our regular programming format. Coming up, I will be speaking with author and hedge fund manager Michael Lewitt. We're going to talk about his new book, The Committee to Destroy the World, Inside the Plot to Unleash a Super Crash on the Global Economy. That's coming up next.
And I'm John Loeffler. In the next hour, we'll be having Jim go on the record where we answer your emails. This is customary for us. At the end of summer, we take a two-week recess and do special programs for 2 weeks. Of course, as our promise always is, and as we did last year, if something really major happens regarding the markets, we will be back with a special show regardless of our time off. So all of that coming up today, as Jim forecasted here on the Financial Sense News Hour.
Over the past 8 years, a small group of politicians, central bankers, and regulators adopted wildly activist policies to solve the debt crisis and promote recovery. Zero interest rates, QE schemes to monetize trillions of dollars, and currency debasement. All of it was guaranteed to lead the world straight into the jaws of another financial crisis. Today, the markets are much more distorted, the world is much more indebted and leveraged, and geopolitics are much more fractured. These corrupt and inept policymakers have no tools left, leaving us on the verge of a super crash that will make 2008 look like a garden party. And that's the thesis of a new book called The Committee to Destroy the World, Inside the Plot to Unleash a Super Crash on the Global Economy. Its author, Michael Lewitt, joins me now. Michael, I want to start out with the title of your book, which was a takeoff of the Time magazine cover of February 99, The Committee to Save the World. It was praised as a troika that saved the world from a global meltdown. A decade later, however, the world came close to a global meltdown. You believe that central banks, politicians, with wild activist policies as we see today, are leading us into the jaws of another financial crisis. Why do you believe that?
Well, I think that the evidence that their policies have failed and are failing are abundantly clear. They've tried to solve a debt crisis by printing trillions of dollars of more debt. They've added on top of that hundreds of billions of dollars of new regulation or new regulatory costs. And somehow they expect the economy to grow under the weight of those burdens. Yeah, I keep telling people that, you know, like only an economist could think that there's no inflation. You know, only an economist could believe that these kinds of policies would work. Jim Grant, author of Grant's Interest Rate Observer, describes the Federal Reserve Board as a bunch of former tenured economics professors, which is exactly what they are. And the problem is they have no understanding or experience of the real world. None of them sat on trading desks. None of them ran businesses. As a result, their policies are having the opposite effect of what they intended. Low interest rates aren't leading people to spend money. They're leading people to save money. And even after it's abundantly clear that stuff isn't working, they just double and triple down on it. So they've left the world much more indebted, much more regulated. The economy is much less dynamic. Markets are clogged up. They're illiquid. And it's just increasingly obvious that something has to change because the current course is going to lead to another crisis. And this crisis will be worse because there's more debt and central banks are much closer to the zero bound in terms of interest rates. So they don't have traditional tools such as lowering rates to solve the problem. Instead, they can, you know, try to buy back more bonds, but they're destroying the markets. I mean, the Japanese central bank owns, I don't know, 30%, 40% of the Japanese bond market, and also a significant amount of the Japanese ETF market, which is insane. The European Central Bank is buying enormous amounts of debt in already illiquid bond markets. And here, of course, the Fed has accumulated $4.5 trillion of assets, but, you know, some of that they had on the books before the crisis. And as a result, the Treasury market is much less liquid than it was. And then added to that, all the regulation has rendered other fixed income markets much less liquid, and even the equity market less liquid. So I think the evidence is apparent and increasing that these policies aren't working. The only thing that's not changing is the policies, which are intensifying. It's very frustrating.
That was one thing that we saw following the global financial crisis. The economic reforms that followed, as you point out in the book, basically went down two particular paths. One was heavy regulation, aka Dodd-Frank, activist monetary policy, as we see today. And what was not clearly understood, and maybe this gets back to the point of being academic, the financial crisis of the last decade was caused by a lot of debt. However, the response has been the creation of more debt that has become epic in its accumulation, and at the same time at rates the lowest in recorded history. Don't these guys see that adding more debt to a crisis that was caused by debt is sending us into another crisis at some point?
I honestly don't know what they see. I really don't have words to express my lack of respect for the people in charge of our policies, because they just keep getting it wrong and they don't learn their lessons. The worst thing about the debt buildup is that you can borrow money and use it for productive purposes. You can spend money on activities that will increase the productive capacity of the economy, the productive capacity of a business, and over time, the economic growth should be able to handle that debt. But that's exactly what's not happening here. We had this stimulus plan that Obama put in place that most of the money was wasted. We have corporations borrowing money not to enhance their productivity, not to build more plant property and equipment, not to do more R&D, but to buy back more stock and to pay more dividends to shareholders, which is completely unproductive. And so as a result, you just have more and more unproductive debt that's being incurred. And that's just a terrible problem. We have a tax system that encourages this. I mean, the absurdity of companies like Apple and Microsoft borrowing billions of dollars overseas so they could pay dividends and buy back stock is so obvious. And what's even worse is both parties in Congress agree this needs to be fixed. But the political leaders are so locked in that they can't seem to get something done. And it's just, you know, you couldn't design this worse if you tried. I mean, honestly. And the problem is low rates cover up a lot of sin, but eventually you got to pay the money back. So when a lot of these companies, when their debts start maturing later in this decade, early in the next decade, they would have had years, unless something changes, of slow growth, of very little free cash flow, and they're not going to be able to do it, and they're going to default. And governments will just keep taxing and increasing spending until there's some kind of real pushback from the citizens. But it's a very unproductive and negative path we're on, and it unfortunately doesn't get enough attention. And those of us who pay attention to it are dismissed as Cassandras and all that stuff until the crisis comes, and then, you know, everybody wants to ring our phones off the hook. I won't be on the other end next time. They can read my book.
Well, let's talk about what politicians have sought to do in an effort to stop too big to fail. They created a regulatory environment in an effort to correct the problems of the last crisis by requiring banks to reduce leverage and risk-taking activities. However, Michael, the way in which the laws were implemented made the financial markets more rigid, less liquid, making them more susceptible to another financial crisis. I don't think people understand that everybody panics when they see the Dow drop 500 points or 1,000 points. We've had days like that in the Treasury market, and nobody talks about it. Explain how this can make the next crisis more severe by making the markets more rigid and less liquid.
The regulations, I think, were well intended. They were designed to deleverage the financial system, the banking system, which was grossly overleveraged heading into the financial crisis, which led to, you know, the failures of Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, and so on. The problem is it sort of went too far in terms of the regulation. The people regulating usually have very limited experience in markets. And so for them, these exercises are largely theoretical. I tell the story in the book of how I got a call from a very senior administration official in early 2009, shortly after Obama took office. And he was concerned because the people surrounding the president wanted to regulators to solve the problem. And that's not a good idea, is it? I said, no, of course it's not a good idea. They have no idea what they're looking at. And ultimately that's what happened. The problem is that derivatives were, you know, stuck in exchanges. Those become too big to fail, or as I call, too big to save because of their own. A lot of derivatives are still not regulated, probably about half the market. Yeah, this is the kind of thing that goes on. Markets are overregulated right now. I mean, it's one thing to want to make sure that banks aren't levered 30-1, but it's another thing to come up with a set of regulations that drives up liquidity in markets. It's one thing to make sure that there's not another Bernie Madoff out there defrauding people. Frankly, there's always going to be other Bernie Madoffs defrauding people. What you need to have is sensible regulation that treats people like adults. We don't have that. We have overregulation that is just making it much harder to conduct business. And, you know, the question is it making investors safer? And I would argue the school is out on that. But in the long term, I'd bet probably not.
Yeah, because the result of these efforts to correct the problems of the last crisis has led to what we now have today, the rise of the regulatory state. I forget the figure you stated in your book, the number of regulations that has come out under Obama. But if you combine regulation with taxation and debt, and then our politicians and economists are perplexed at the economy's inability to grow. A good example was Q2 figures. They were projecting 2.6% growth rate. They got 1.2.
Right. The problem is nobody wants to connect the dots, or just there's not the political will to force changes. It's very hard to understand. I can tell you this. If you go to Congress and you start trying to talk to people about what the Federal Reserve does, you get like blank stares. They don't understand. And this is one of the great things that's going on is what the Federal Reserve does is largely hidden. It's complex and most people don't understand it. It's very different than like reading about a Supreme Court decision about abortion or something, which average people understand. Average people don't understand the fractional reserve banking system. They don't understand how the Federal Reserve manipulates the price of money. They don't really understand what a central bank is or what it should do. And as a result, you know, we have a system where the most powerful government agency in the world, the Federal Reserve, really operates without very many checks and balances. It has very, very expansive powers that were further expanded by Dodd-Frank, by the way, and to make it more of a regulator as well as a central bank. And it's having an enormous effect, and it's having a negative effect because virtually all the members of the Federal Open Market Committee, I'm thinking of Neil Kashkari, who's probably the one exception, all come from the same background. They're all academic economists. They all believe in models, and they don't really have any real-world sense. What I find amazing is when I give talks, everybody laughs at this. Janet Yellen's married to one of the foremost behavioral economists in the world, George Akerlof. He won a Nobel Prize for behavioral economics. And they must not talk because behavioral economists understand that real people react to incentives in certain ways and they don't communicate because all her models and everything, they don't work. And she's still thinking there isn't enough inflation, unemployment is where it is. And she's just operating from the wrong playbook. And as a result, you know, lowering rates further when they're already at zero isn't going to accomplish anything. And sucking up all the liquidity out of the bond market isn't going to do anything. I mean, yes, it creates some more liquidity for the stock market, but the stock market's operating on fumes. The Shiller cyclically adjusted price earnings ratio, which smooths out the price earning ratios over a period of time and is a very good measure of the stock market values, is at 27 times. It has only been higher twice, in 2000 and in 1929. So that's what we have as a result of low interest rates, a stock market that's very expensive, built on largely phony earnings because of all these non-GAAP adjustments, and is fueled by massive stock repurchases by companies who are not reinvesting in their businesses. So why anybody should be sanguine about what's going on is beyond me, because I think we're in a very fragile environment that reality will eventually come home to roost. And when it does, the system is less robust to be able to deal with it.
You know, it could be argued, Michael, that the aggressive monetary policy that CB's pursued after the financial fallout kept the financial system from collapsing. However, it raises a question as to why central banks are pursuing crisis-era policies like we see today, long after the crisis has passed. In fact, some would argue that the time to have started raising interest rates was years ago rather than more recently.
Oh, there's no question. They should have started raising rates at the latest in 2014. They adopted crisis era policies during the crisis, which were necessary, lowering rates, you know, maybe the first round of QE and so on. The problem is they persisted in those policies long after the crisis continued. Now, another way of looking at that is the crisis actually never ended, that it just was sort of suppressed, and that's why these policies are in place. But I would argue that that argument doesn't really work. I think that the bottom line is the crisis was over by end of 2009 at the latest, and they needed to trust markets. The problem is central bankers don't trust markets. The government doesn't trust markets. We have a massive, burgeoning, expanding regulatory state because the government does not trust the people to manage themselves. And it's a terrible, terrible situation. It's leading to a bad outcome. It's harder and harder to do business in this country because basically the government doesn't trust people to do business on their own.
You know, one of the problems is that prior to the crisis, people like yourself and others were warning of the crisis and predicted its outcome. The issue, I guess, that comes up after the crisis was over, the government, instead of seeking the advice of people like yourself or others that predicted it, went to the same people that didn't see it coming, and they're not going to the right place to get information. And you really get a sense of this, Michael. Have you ever watched when the Fed chairman goes on Capitol Hill and testifies the questions that come from politicians? It's obvious a lot of these guys don't know how the real economy works. They don't understand how the Fed works. So one of the problems, I believe, is they're going to the wrong place for solutions.
Well, it's embarrassing to see Congress question the Federal Reserve chairman. It's just an embarrassment because they have no clue, 90% of the Congress people, what they're talking about. And yeah, look, I mean, it's not an easy road to hoe to be a critic of the status quo or critic of the consensus. And people don't want to hear from you. It just doesn't fit in with their narrative, and it's not in their interest. And that's just how the world works. So, you know, I write about this in the book that, you know, that if your fund was down 80%, they were the first guy you call. But if you were Michael Burry or Steve Eisman, I think his name is at Front Point, or some of these other guys who are totally brilliant who saw the thing coming, or Kyle Bass or somebody like that, or myself who was writing about this, they don't want to hear from you because you're an outsider. You're not an insider. So, you know, it's a systemic kind of phenomenon. That's why I was so surprised to get that call from that senior official, although, of course, he wasn't able to ever get me in the room with the guys because they didn't want to hear it. And this is the problem. No one wants to hear it until it's too late. And then even then, most people don't want to hear it. And as a result, problems just persist and they deepen and they don't get fixed. And that's why it's so sort of sad now to see the spectacle of this election, because you don't have any prospect of realistic change coming in a constructive way. You know, you have likely a very status quo kind of candidate who is part of the establishment who's going to win. And unfortunately, the outsider who was nominated doesn't appear to be serious enough about the job to impress people that he can do it. And so we're just going to have more of the same. And this is not going to change. It's just a matter of how you prepare yourself for continuation and for when the volatility and the consequences happen, which they will.
And this is something that I want to talk about, because two facts that emerged from the crisis is debt continues to grow at astronomical levels. I think global debt is over $200 trillion. The derivative market is $650 trillion. And isn't that derivative market hanging over the financial system like the sword of Damocles? I mean, goodness, I forget what world GDP is, but it's dwarfed by the size of derivatives. And you're talking about a market that is so opaque that not even those who write the contracts or trade in them really understand their financial vulnerability.
Well, I think the guys who trade them understand on a micro basis the contracts. The problem is the guys running the banks that are counterparties to these really, for the most part, don't. If they did, they wouldn't have that much exposure on their books. I mean, there's 550 trillion round numbers of global derivatives. And, you know, take a bank like JP Morgan. I don't know what the number is today. Maybe it's 45 trillion. Maybe it's 50 trillion. You know, what's $5 trillion between friends? But the point is their book value, you know, their shareholders' equity is, you know, a few $100 billion. So the derivatives exposure dwarfs their book value. So if there were a serious blow up, there'd be a problem. Now, most derivatives are interest rate derivatives and they're, you know, swapping fixed into floating or back the other way. The problem is we've had, in addition to suppressing interest rates, the Fed has suppressed volatility and it's suppressed the volatility of interest rates. So if interest rate volatility increases significantly, a lot of those contracts may give rise to losses. And the bigger risk is that you have one institution, at least in the world, Deutsche Bank, that has something on the order of $60 trillion in derivatives. It has a weak balance sheet. It is among the worst managed institutions in the world. It has been a serial lawbreaker. They have been in trouble for years with the New York Fed for insufficient financial controls on their U.S. operations. And that is the institution that worries me the most. It's the closest we have to anything that could pose an AIG risk. But derivatives are sort of the elephant in the room that no one wants to talk about. U.S. banks are much better capitalized and more liquid than they were before the financial crisis. That's a good thing. And everything will be fine unless derivatives become a problem, because you have four banks, JP Morgan, Citi, B of A, and Goldman, that have the largest concentration of derivatives. Then it drops off sharply. But their exposures are hundreds of times their book value. So it's just something that you just have to hope that nothing goes wrong. If Deutsche Bank is unable to meet its obligations, there are counterparties on the other side of that $60 trillion that include those four banks and every other institution in the world that are going to have a problem. And it's a huge daisy chain. So the problem with derivatives has not been solved. It's been glossed over. Wall Street was among the strongest forces in opposing meaningful change, despite what they say, because it's a profitable area for them until it blows up. And it's just floating out there. Then you get to the debt. There's, you know, $200 trillion plus of debt globally. There's no way the global economy has the productive capacity to be able to repay that debt. So we're going to end up with lots of defaults, and then we're going to end up with currency devaluation and inflation in order to pay the debt. And that's where we sit. And I think over the next few years, the dominant themes in the investing world are going to be inflation and currency volatility, because that's the only way to deal with the debt in an environment of slow growth, because it's impossible. You know, if you're climbing a mountain and you don't have a 100-pound pack, and then you have a 100-pound pack on your back, you're going to go slower with the pack on your back. Well, the global economy has a 100-pound pack on its back. It's called $200 trillion in debt and then this massive regulatory infrastructure. So how can the world possibly grow? How can the U.S. possibly grow at 4% again when it's buried in debt and regulation? The answer is it can't. You don't have to be an economist to understand this. You just have to have a functioning frontal cortex and be able to think. It's very, very obvious that you can't operate, you know, when you have to work just to stay even before you can grow. And that's what we're dealing with now.
You know, I want to stay on the topic of derivatives for a minute, because those that would argue for keeping derivatives is they're saying by the time you take the net position of derivatives, it's certainly not as large as it is. But you argue in your book, Michael, what really matters is the nominal value of derivatives. So, for example, let's say I had a $100 million long position in the market, but to minimize my risk, I have an $80 million short position, so my net is only $20 million long. The problem is, I see twofold. Number one, the $80 million that I have short is dependent on those who honor that contract to come and pay off those contracts should the markets work against me. That's number one. Number two, if you take this derivative market, as you point out in your book, it is really concentrated in a small handful of players. So you mentioned the Deutsche Bank, $60 trillion derivative book. You know, probably some of the counterparties on the other side are Goldman, Bank of America, Citigroup, and JP Morgan. So if one party goes bad, as we saw in AIG, it's a domino effect throughout the entire financial system.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, there are two problems. The first is that, what is a derivative? It's a contract. There are two parties. If one party can't fulfill the contract, the other party suffers a loss, and then they have various recourses that take years to happen. So that's a really serious problem that should put the fear of God into people, and it should put the fear of God into the Wall Street firms that were so busy trying to fight back against regulation. Another thing the firms did, which now the, I think it's the CFTC is putting an end to, is they would move their derivatives trades to London where there's no regulation. So they would be completely unregulated. But I think the CFTC has cracked down on that. Two things. First of all, the nominal derivative size is still in the trillions. So it's a problem. But yes, the second point is exactly what you said. In a crisis, it's the gross, not the nominal, that matters, because the netting won't occur like it's supposed to, because one party isn't going to be there, or several, many parties won't be there to net because they're incapable of meeting their obligations. So it's a fallacy to depend on the netting to save you in a crisis, because that's precisely when the netting doesn't occur. But that's the argument that is most often used to justify the current situation. And unfortunately, just like in 2008, until the bad thing happens, you know, everybody can sort of say, well, everything's fine, I told you so, nothing's happening, and so on. But people should really take the object lesson of AIG in 2008 and really pay attention, because AIG had a $1 trillion balance sheet. By comparison, Lehman had like a $600 billion balance sheet, and it couldn't meet its obligations. Contracts are complicated. Some of them have clauses where you have to put up more collateral if you get downgraded, which is what happened to AIG. There are other things that happen. And that could easily happen again. I mean, Deutsche Bank is a real serious risk because It has a lot of bad debts on its books, and it's so poorly managed, and its capital is eroding, its stock price is getting destroyed. I mean, if that happens, and what do people think? All of a sudden, magically, these counterparties are going to not be harmed? They're going to be harmed. Of course, what's going to have to happen is the German government, with respect to Deutsche Bank, and the U.S. government, because it's the U.S., is going to have to somehow come in and stand behind the global system while the smoke clears. Because with a lot of these financial contracts, in the end, I lived this through the Drexel Burnham bankruptcy, but you also saw this at Lehman. You saw this at MF Global. You see it at a lot of these financial institutions. Once the smoke clears, the immediate aftermath, when people are not meeting their obligations, these contracts have no value, there are massive losses, and so on. If you can get a government to stand behind and somehow give some kind of guarantee, soft guarantee, whatever, it might be able to mitigate that. But we didn't do that in AIG. We did, you know, the structure of the bailout was we loaned the money and all the rest. And that was controversial because it allowed Goldman and some European banks to get paid on swaps that they really shouldn't have been made whole on. They should have had some losses. So we haven't really addressed the problem. It's a little better. I mean, you know, we do have wind-up provisions for these institutions and so on, but it'll be chaos just like it was the last time, because the markets are not built on anything more than confidence and psychology. And regardless of what things have been put in place, people are going to freak out when somebody goes down, and the losses will still be major.
I want to talk about a particular type of contract, and that's the credit default swap. Now, for our listeners, it's basically bond insurance. You're buying insurance on a bond in case the company defaults on the bond itself. But credit default swaps are handled differently in the financial industry. And Michael, I wonder if you might explain the risk here, because if I'm an insurance company, and let's say I sell you a life insurance policy, or I'm a property and casualty company, or a car insurance company, I sell you insurance. I take the premiums that you pay me, I set them aside as reserves, I invest them, and I try to earn money so that in the case of somebody passing away, a house catches on fire, or a car accident, I have the funds to pay out. Credit default swaps, in many cases, were booked as income and profits with no reserves. Isn't that one of the issues that took place with AIG?
Biggest issue is that you don't have to have an insurable instrument where you buy a swap on. You can buy naked swaps where you could just speculate on something going down, and you have incentive to see the instrument fail, for bankruptcy, and then you get paid out. So that's the really sort of perverse problem of credit default swaps, is that they create a very one-sided incentive for failure. And as a result, when you get into like these corporate restructures and bankruptcies, these large ones like Caesars or something like that, you have a situation where the normal creditor relationship really doesn't hold. So there were good ideas that sort of went awry.
I want to talk about something that I guess alarms me in many ways. As you pointed out, 90% of these instruments are credit related, and they're related to interest rates themselves. When we're looking at the lowest interest rates in recorded history, should the markets lose confidence like they did in the late 70s and demand higher interest rates, doesn't this create a potential crisis with all these derivative contracts? I just can't imagine $650 trillion worth of derivatives would suddenly readjust to the rise in rates.
Just to be clear, interest rate derivatives, they react to changes in interest rates, not to the credit quality of any kind of instrument. But yes, that's sort of what I mentioned before, is that volatility and interest rate volatility has been artificially suppressed. So it's sort of a sense of false comfort that there haven't been any disruptions yet in that market, because so much of the, you know, the derivatives market is based on moves in interest rates. And when you have zero interest rates, like over in Europe, this happened about a year and a half ago or so, the first time 10-year German bond rates went down to about 10 basis points, and then they sprang back to like 100 basis points, the losses are really significant because it's bond math. And, you know, the percentage move is enormous. And so you're going to have that this time. And it's unknown what's going to happen, but I think there's a false sense of security, because I'm sure what's likely is that the pricing of these contracts has also been affected by the long period of low volatility. So they're underpriced. I mean, what happened with AIG, of course, is they grew underpriced. The insurance they sold on AAA pieces of subprime mortgage collateralized debt obligations. And the reason for that was because they were going off incorrect models and assumptions about what the housing market would do and what the defaults would be in those instruments. And so they were just sort of using the wrong data. And here, the data we have is based on a very artificial environment where rates are suppressed. And if things normalize more, there'll be more volatility, and there'll probably be some issues with those contracts. Look, I'm not saying the world's going to end. I'm just saying that we have this sort of overlay over the entire financial market of these derivatives that very few people understand or appreciate, and that are probably mispriced because of the prolonged period of low volatility, which means that nothing good can happen from this. Maybe things stay the same, which I think is unlikely, or something bad happens, meaning losses. But one of the sort of most common attributes of human beings, and this is very important in the investment world, is that people assume that current conditions will continue into the future indefinitely. And that is probably the worst assumption you can make as an investor. What you have to do as an investor, and what I do, is assume that we are one step away from disaster at all times, that current conditions will not persist, and how do I protect against the downside of what's coming? Because if you don't do that, you know, the upside will take care of itself if you do what you're supposed to do. But if you don't protect against the downside, you can give back years of returns in the blink of an eye. And especially in a low return environment like now, that's what a lot of people are going to see. I mean, people are chasing the stock market up now. They don't realize they will give back these gains and more when the market comes to its senses. And in the bond world, where, you know, the largest bond funds in the world are, you know, lucky to make an average return of 2% over the last couple of years. And after inflation, that's zero. And after real world inflation, it's negative. You do not want to be sort of walking further and further out on the plank, assuming that conditions are going to persist. Nothing persists. There's this great investor, John Burbank, who runs a firm called, it's called Passport Capital in San Francisco. And he always says, there's no way to predict how the world is going to look 5 years from now. Think about 5 years ago, and think about, could you have said how the world's going to look now? And just sitting here now in 2016, you have to be out of your mind to think you can say what you think the world's going to look like in 2021. And the investment world particularly, you have no idea. And anybody who thinks he does is somebody you probably want to be very wary of.
I want to move on to something that underlies the whole financial system, whether we're looking at the bond market, the stock market, or even derivatives. And that's a system that is based on trust, Michael, and confidence. Are we at risk in this fragile system that we now have globally that confidence is lost? What happens, and it will happen someday, when market players wake up and they figure out these guys don't know what they're doing and they can't fix it? And when that confidence is lost, risk premiums skyrocket, and then we're in a full-blown crisis.
Well, that's what happened in 2008. I mean, people lost trust. That's why counterparties didn't perform on derivatives contracts and all kinds of other contracts. In the end, that's all we have is trust and the belief that if you enter into any kind of trade or contract with somebody, that the other party will fulfill his obligation. That's why it's so damaging when the government acts in ways that undercut trust. And that's, I think, the situation we're finding. That's why I think this election is so significant. You have one candidate who appears to be right now who nobody trusts. Nobody believes anything she says. So if we have another financial crisis, is she going to have the leadership ability and the moral authority to get people to make sacrifices? I think that's a real issue. And, you know, when the government acts in ways that are dishonest, when they make false statements and so on, as our government does on many topics, it creates real questions of trust. What's amazing to me is that the Federal Reserve, which says lots of things, none of which ever come true, it is the worst financial forecaster in the history of mankind, yet people still believe in what they say. Now, I think they believe in what they say because what they really believe is the Fed will do anything to stop the stock market from going down and will keep printing money forever. I think that's a very dangerous assumption, but people have given the Fed much more credit than it deserves and much more trust than it deserves for its policies. And part of that is because what the Fed, as I said before, what the Fed does is very mysterious and hidden and complicated for average people. And it's not something you can take out on the campaign trail and reduce to a soundbite. And that's, maybe that's good, maybe that's bad. But at some point, reality will intervene and people will understand that this isn't working. I mean, what's strange to me is if you look around the country, a lot of these policies are not doing good things for average Americans, whether it's free trade, which is now being, I think, properly questioned, you know, not given a blank check, low interest rates. These things are not helping the average person. And at some point, you would hope that the citizens of the country would wake up and realize that they need to demand better policies and more accountability from their leaders. But it hasn't happened yet. But when that day happens, we saw it in 2008, and the government stepped in, when people lose trust, the market stops. The problem now is, if the government had to step in again, you know, like we have a recession, the Fed normally has 300 to 500 basis points of interest rates that it can lower to stop a recession or to, you know, get us out of recession. They don't have that anymore. Their balance sheet's already swollen, although it can go higher. You know, central banks are sort of out of bullets. And so as a result, that faith that people have that the Fed's going to come and step in is something they should be questioning, because I don't think it's going to work the way it has in the past.
I want to move on to something you write about in your book, and that's Hyman Minsky's financial instability hypothesis. And for our listeners, it basically goes like this. The better things get, the better they are expected to continue to be. Human beings tend to extrapolate current conditions indefinitely into the future. So based on these assumptions, everything's going along well, people take on more risk. He also talked about, in stabilizing an unstable economy, he talked about three steps or phases in the process. One was hedge finance, where economic actors expect cash flows from their businesses to be sufficient to meet their obligations. The second phase was speculative finance, where they do not expect cash flows from operations to be sufficient, but partially their short-term obligations. In this phase, actors roll over their existing debt. And finally, we get to Ponzi finance. In your opinion, what phase are we in Minsky's financial instability thesis?
Well, we're clearly well into Ponzi finance, where you're just borrowing new money to pay back old money. I would say we're at the late stages of Ponzi finance, except it could go on for a while, but governments, corporations, everybody is just borrowing to repay old debt. And I think that Ponzi finance, like a Ponzi scheme, and that title is not accidental, does not end well. At some point, you got to come up with real money to pay your debts, or I think in our case, we're going to devalue the value of money to pay our debts through inflation and currency debauchment. That's all you can do.
Yeah, you know, this is something I wanted to bring up because, you know, beginning at the new millennium, George Bush came in, George W. Bush, that is, he doubled the national debt from $5 trillion to $10 trillion. Obama comes in 2008. When he leaves office in January, he'll double the national debt to $20 trillion. And I don't know if it's Trump or Clinton looking more like Clinton. It's obvious we are doubling our debt or growing our debt at a faster rate of growth than the economy itself, there's only several ways that you get rid of debt. Either one, you pay it off, two, you default on it, or three, you inflate it or devalue it.
Those are the only four ways of repaying debt. So that's some kind of radical technological business transformation. The global economy is not going to grow fast enough to service $200 trillion of debt. And our economy is not going to grow fast enough to service, you know, $20 trillion of debt, which has behind it $60 trillion of future promises that we can't keep. So that's off the table. There will be lots of defaults, and entities that don't default, like governments, will devalue their currencies and inflate away. You can only create debt out of the air. You can't create equity. You got to earn it. And one of the things I read about in the book is that we really need to change our tax code, which is the DNA of the economy, to eliminate the incentives that favor debt over equity. I don't see any reason in the world, other than the fact that it's sort of the way it is, that we give tax breaks to people who borrow money rather than people who, you know, invest equity. There shouldn't be a subsidy for borrowing money. Because when you borrow money and you get to write it off, you're basically making every other taxpayer in the United States a partner in your transaction. We should discourage debt. We should encourage equity. We should discourage speculation. We should encourage productive investment. And in order to do that, you need to change the tax code, which right now does the opposite and encourages all the bad trends that are increasing financial fragility and future chances of financial instability.
You know, Michael, I want to talk about something that probably didn't exist during the period of 2007 and 2009 in the financial crisis, and that's geopolitical risk. If we look, Bush took out Saddam Hussein, and Obama took out Muammar Gaddafi. So if you take a look at the Middle East today, we have ISIS. You take a look at the terrorist attacks. I think I read somewhere that in Europe, there's a terrorist attack every 72 hours. And terrorism used to be something we watched on TV. It usually took place in Israel and the Middle East. But it's not just the war on terror. You have Russia moving in the Ukraine on the day we're doing this interview. Russia is flying bombers and planes out of Iran, which we've never seen before. We have China moving into the South China Seas, aggressively building military bases. So the world has become unstable. What risk does this pose to the system? Because this kind of risk wasn't as prevalent back in 2007 as pronounced as it is today.
There'll be more terrorist attacks, that there could be potential regional wars. We already have one across the entire Middle East. There's risks in, you know, the South China Sea. There's risks in Ukraine. You know, Obama was uniquely unqualified to be commander-in-chief when it came to foreign policy, and he's demonstrated that, you know, consistently. And while the list of his mistakes is honestly too long to discuss here, there were two threshold big mistakes he made. The first was leaving Iraq without a status of forces agreement, which, despite his protests to the contrary, was not necessary. It was merely an attempt to fulfill a campaign promise, and it unleashed the ability for ISIS to effectively take over a huge amount of territory there. And the second error he made was the Iran nuclear deal, which was not only treasonous and a violation of the Constitution, but empowered the world's largest state sponsor of terrorism to continue acting contrary to the interests of the West. And why he did this, he can explain better than me. But these two mistakes, along with countless other smaller ones that are of the same ilk, have left America with a diminished standing in the world, a diminished ability to influence events, with diminished respect from its allies. And it's just been a catastrophe on all fronts. And the consequence for investors is, you know, war is bad for business. If you look at the history of the last couple of centuries, you know, economic growth during periods of war is wiped out. I mean, do you think people are actually wanting to start businesses in Afghanistan or Iraq or Syria when bombs are dropping? It's just bad for business. So it's just a bad way to run the world. And the fact is, you know, I remember Niall Ferguson, the history professor at Harvard, was asked by, I think it was Barron's, you know, they're saying, well, you know, America can't be the world's policeman. And he said, damn well they can be. Who do you want it to be, China or Russia? I mean, the fact is that there's a reason why the post-World War II structure and general peace, meaning no more world wars, has stayed in place. One big reason is because of the United States hegemony. And that hegemony has been completely eroded by an incompetent commander-in-chief who has really damaged the future prospects of the world. And who knows what the next president will bring, but this is a very serious problem. It didn't exist in 2007 before the crisis. It didn't exist when Obama took office, but it's been straight downhill since then, and we're going to pay the price for years to come.
I want to talk about where we are today. In your opinion, and as you view the world the way they exist, is it, number one, too late to fix? And if indeed we are headed into another crisis, as the title of your book suggests, it will be more severe than those that preceded it. What kind of world will we live in after the next crisis? What will it look? Just as you mentioned, that hedge fund manager saying it's very difficult to predict what the world would look like 5 years from now is the world we live in today. I don't think anybody foresaw 5 years ago. What happens and what does it look like in your opinion?
Well, I think the risk of a crisis being much worse are very high because, again, because of all the debt, because of the geopolitical stability, you know, global growth is terrible. Global trade is down at recession or even 2008 levels. It's a very serious situation. So the world is less robust and less prepared to be able to handle it. And so that's a problem. Look, there are things we can do to improve our prospects. As I said, we can fix our tax code. There are a number of things we can do to slow the growth of debt, to improve economic growth. You know, in a country as big as ours, if we can just change the trajectory a bit, it can definitely improve our prospects. I mean, America has, a lot of good things going for it. But we need to change the trajectory. You know, it's like, you know, they said with Obamacare, they changed the trajectory of healthcare spending. Well, that didn't exactly work out very well, despite what they claim. You need to change the growth of entitlements and limit them. You need to, you know, lower the growth of debt, and you need to figure out how to improve productivity and improve economic growth. And the ways to do that are to fix the tax code, reduce regulation, let the economy rather than the government run things. So there is opportunity to make things better, but it's going to be difficult because, you know, entitlements take up, what, 2/3 of the budget. We already have a lot of debt. We dug ourselves a deep hole, but we have the ability to make things better, or at least to slow down the worsening of the situation if we do these things. But they take fairly radical form. I think the world we're looking at for, you know, my best guess is we're going to continue to have slow growth because economies cannot grow with this much debt and this much regulation. And the risk of violence from the lowest level of the kind of violence we see in the inner cities in the United States to then the next level, which is terrorist attacks here and in Europe, and much worse in the Middle East, just no one really hears about them in Africa, places like that. And then to the final level, which is war, is going to notch up until we get real leaders and real structures in place that are more robust. Right now, all kinds of institutional structures are being eroded, both in this country and outside the country, and we need to address these problems before they get worse. Unfortunately, nothing's being done. I mean, I don't understand, for example, why the president has not sent the National Guard into Chicago, his hometown, to try to stop the runaway violence in the black neighborhoods there. There's no excuse for it. And that violence is happening in Baltimore, Milwaukee, all these cities. And very little is being done to honestly address the problem. And when you address it honestly, you're called racist. Well, it's not racist to point out that the problems are based on black-on-black violence that are due to lack of opportunity, lack of jobs, lack of education, that 50 years of progressive policies have not solved. So it's time to figure out another plan, a better plan. All these places have been under the governance of progressives and liberals for the last 50 years. Well, it's not working. Maybe it's time to try something else. The problem is we're so crippled by political correctness and by a media that is, you know, hopelessly biased that it's very hard to get honest dialogue out there without getting, you know, masses of abuse. I know because I get the abuse. I don't care. It's important to speak out honestly about these problems because they're only getting worse. And that's where we are. So that's what I see. I mean, we need people to step up and lead and be willing to take the heat and be able to speak honestly and try to make real changes to our economy, our cities, our society, our culture, everything. Otherwise, things are just going to continue to deteriorate.
Let's talk about how to protect from a crisis like this, which we know is inevitable. You know, Michael, the average person on the street or the average investor probably doesn't fully comprehend central bank policy. I don't think they understand it themselves, as we talked about. In a lot of the complexities of the financial system, whether it's credit default swaps, derivatives, the interconnectedness of our large financial institutions today, what investment strategy can be employed so that you can protect? Because you never know how these things erupt. Nobody was expecting the day Lehman erupted and then triggered a daisy chain of events, as we saw in the fall of 2008. What do investors need to do to protect themselves?
Well, I think the first thing they need to do is get out of the bond market. The bond market has been destroyed by the Fed. Bonds generate, almost without exception, except some junk bonds, which involve a lot of risk, negative inflation-adjusted rates of return. The first thing they should do is sell all their bonds. That's just not something they should own. They should own some gold, because gold will maintain and increase its value as central banks continue to debauch the currency. They need to be very cautious about equities, because equities, you know, as I said, the Shiller P's are like 27 times, which is the highest it's been since 2000 and 1929. So they need to be very careful with their equity exposure, and they need to hedge it or be prepared for significant volatility. Over the long run, stocks will still generate pretty high returns, you know, higher than bonds, but the market's very expensive. And then those who can, you know, should be looking for unique alternative strategies that are market neutral, that are not dependent on the direction of the market. My firm manages strategies like that, where you're extracting returns from the market, not from direction necessarily, but from things like, you know, time value of options or stuff like that. People shouldn't be afraid to hold cash, because they'll be able to use that cash to buy distressed assets when the market corrects. And they should just be patient. But now is not the time to be a hero. Now's the time to worry about protecting your capital, not compounding it, because it's very hard to compound capital unless you have a unique strategy that you've developed, or unless you're enormously talented and able to pick the stocks that are going to go up. I think that the whole phenomenon of the FANG stocks, the Facebooks and the Amazons and so on, is going to end like every other bubble has ended before, and people are going to be very disappointed. So I think right now is the time to sort of regroup and sort of remain on guard. When the market cracks, there'll be opportunities to act, and that's when you act.
Finally, Michael, given the fact that you expect that we are heading for another financial crisis, there's nothing that has changed. We have more debt today. The interconnectedness of the markets are more so today. The big have gotten bigger. What kind of things would you be looking for to tell you that we're coming close to the next crisis? What telltale signs, if you were to spot them, would you be looking at?
Well, normally higher volatility points to changes in market direction. But what we've seen over the last, since the crisis, is we've had bouts of it, but then it's sort of returned to normal. Like after the Brexit, the market plunged and then it came back very quickly. In January, plunged, came back very quickly. Last August, plunged, came back very quickly. So it's harder than ever to look for traditional signs of that, because the central banks have so distorted everything. I'm not sure I have a really good answer for that, because I think one day we're just going to sort of wake up and people are going to start questioning the ability of the central banks to keep things afloat, and, you know, they'll start selling. I think the market is vulnerable to that, but I can't really point to anything specific, because the normal things I look at, you know, I look at things like the TED spread, I look at LIBOR, I look at lots of indicators. They've all been distorted. You know, the antenna has sort of been snapped off the market, as Pippa Malgram, who's an economist, said. And so it's very hard to point to traditional levels. I just think if you look at normal things like valuation, you look at the Shiller PE, if you look at bond yields, I mean, it's obvious that things are just, there's no value in the market, and you just have to be very careful. It's sort of the 200 trillion dollar question, or maybe it's the $650 trillion question. You know, what's going to trigger a correction or worse? And the answer is always, you know, an exogenous event, some kind of horrible event that happens, or something that's more subtle, that, you know, you maybe have a Deutsche Bank have a problem or something like that. But it's really hard to know. I don't really have a great answer, because I think all the signs have been distorted by what the Fed and everybody else is doing.
Well, listen, Michael, I want to thank you for joining us on a special edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. As visitors to our website have pointed out, I included it on one of my top reading lists for summer vacation. So I want to thank you for writing a great book. The name of the book is called The Committee to Destroy the World, Inside the Plot to Unleash a Super Crash on the Global Economy by Michael Lewitt, who has joined me on today's program. Michael, all the best to you, sir, and much success with this book.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Coming up next, Jim Poplava goes on the record as he answers many of your emails as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.